Give me a beat. Thank you for pushing play. You are listening to the Ray Ray is Fundamental podcast, episode 66. And thank God 2016 is done. No one really cares about the guy on the bottom. No one really cares about the guy beneath. And everybody wants to be down with the dude on top of the stairs. Top of the stairs. Cause no one really cares about the guy on the bottom. No one really cares about the guy beneath. And everybody wants to be down with the dude on top of the stairs. Top of the stairs. What's up, Internet? This is the Ray Ray is Fundamental podcast, episode 66, being recorded on January the 6th, 2017, brought to you by RayRay.net and the Happy Hour Network. My name is Ray Morali, also known as Ray Ray. And as you know, I am an NBA online writer, thenotlocast.com, forumblueandgold.com, and other sites. So this could usually be an NBA podcast, but this is my podcast after all. So I talk about whatever else in pop culture, whether it's anime or video games or anything old school, because I love nostalgia. I love the 90s and stuff like that. And I'm really not going to get any more wordy after this, because we're going to talk about Fuller House with my partner, E.J. Christian, for Kicking It Old School. And after that Fuller House talk, I'm going to talk NBA with super NBA writer Matt Moore of CBSSports.com. Adam Jacoby, of course, is going to join me, as he is, of course, the greatest storyteller of all time. But really, you're going to hear a story from Matt Moore before we go NBA. But in the meantime, let's talk DJ, Stephanie, Kimmy Gibbler, Fuller House with EJ Christian.
Kicking it old school with Ray Ray and EJ.
Kicking it old school. It's 2017 with me, Ray Ray, and of course my buddy EJ Christian. What's up,
my man Ray Moraldi? Happy New Year! Happy 2017. Hopefully it's a better year. Hopefully it's a more positive year.
You're telling me.
It feels rough.
Yeah. So New Year, 2017, and here's the thing, like. It's a little weird, but it's kind of nice because 2017 also signifies that I'm 20 years out of high school. I am old, dude.
20-year reunion. Wow.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm not about any of my reunions yet. I remember when they first did a 10-year reunion for me in 2008. I didn't go, and I was invited to it to go, but I don't really remember much people in my high school. Once I left high school, I was done. I didn't keep up with anybody other than, like, maybe two people.
Did you have a bad experience? I don't think so, right?
No, it's just, I've been to so many places. Like, look, I'm still in South Florida. I mean, I went to high school in Miami, but then I moved out of Miami after high school. I moved to Fort Lauderdale, and then I moved to West Palm Beach County. So, and I didn't have a lot of bonds with people in high school either, to be honest with you. I had a couple of guys I was cool with. I'm still cool with today. But other than that, most of my friends I actually still have from, like, way back when, actually from middle school, than anything else.
Yeah, it's the same thing for me. It's like I didn't have too many bonds in high school, and then I kind of made that little status on Facebook, like, oh man, I'm 20 years out of high school, right? And then suddenly my friend's like, hey, so you want to help out in our 20-year reunion committee? I'm like, sure. And every day in this year so far, I've talked to them, a lot of catching up, a lot of organizing and stuff like that. So it's been kind of cool, 20 years, like, you know. It'll be cool to see those people again.
I can see you doing that, like being the that is in charge of the music and you start playing all your 90s mixtapes and stuff. I just start playing another, testing them out if you're still legit. Oh, God, Ray.
Oh, yeah.
You doing that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's like we all, like, obviously we're all the same class, we're all the same age, so of course we're going to love, like, all the same music, basically, whether it's, you know.
You're class 97, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That means you have 1 year on me, then. I'm 98.
Yeah, yeah. So
you are old.
I am old. So this segues to, because, you know, the show we're going to talk about also had a 20-year reunion in one of their episodes. We're talking about Fuller House.
Yeah,
it's a sequel to Full House, and you know, I know it is kind of old school in a way where it's like we're basically like, you know, Fuller House, while it's released in the past year or so, it still feels like a nostalgic 90s comedy series to us, you know?
Yeah, it really does. And remember when they first announced a couple of years ago, like, you know, they were planning on doing this and all that. I remember being pretty excited about it. Because you and I, we're the same age, so we, you know, used to be able to watch the show where it was actually on TV. Not a syndication, but it actually aired on TV on Friday night on part of the TGIF lineup. So that had a big part. I mean, I don't know if you're a big fan of the show growing up, but I know I was a pretty big fan of the show growing up for the first couple seasons. And, yeah, it's one of those things where the nostalgia, even in the new incarnation of the show, it's still, you still feel the old school feel to it.
Yeah, definitely, because there's a lot of 90s music there, and obviously Kimmy Gilbert still doing her 90s dances and all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can never forget, like, you know, DJ and Stephanie. I mean, they're just 90s icons, you know what I mean? So you just can't forget them, and like...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, the... Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, and one thing I will say that really, one of the successes of the show, I think that no one's talking about, is the fact that, you know, when they first announced the idea of them coming back as this incarnation, you know, the biggest question was, well, will Mary Kate Ashley also be part of this whole thing? And, you know, obviously they're not part of it. And to be honest with you, it's actually been pretty good without them. Honestly, I can't really imagine them being part of this.
Yeah, it's a little weird because, like, anyway, most of the show was centered on, you know, the teenagers, right?
Right.
And obviously the dad, or, you know, Uncle Jesse and Dave Cooley's character or whatever. He's still doing his shtick whenever he's on the show. But I like the nice touches that they put in there. It's like, oh, you can unlock actually make an appearance in Full House, which is kind of nice, right? So,
right. And like I said, I think they've been able to, you know, because people were wondering, well, could the show survive without the twins? And, you know, honestly, mm-hmm. it really has. Because I think there's enough personalities on this show. You know, I think, you know, all the main characters of the show are interesting enough as adults that they can take away from the need for the twins. So I think Full House has been a success. I've really enjoyed the first two seasons, especially the second season too, because of the fact that what they've done with season two now is the fact that they've still kept the nostalgic feel to the show, but you can tell if you watch the show very carefully, it's actually starting to create its own thing now. You start seeing Full House be its own, get its own identity for that matter. And I think that's the one success of the show, is the fact that they've been able to not have to rely on, okay, well, you know, the old names and all this. And look, they've done a good job with that, with bringing some of the old school characters back, even some of the cameos and stuff. But Full House has actually carved its own identity out, which is really good. I think that's the success of the show right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You mentioned like how they don't have to rely on the old characters in the second season, because in the first season it felt like, you know, it's a reacquaintance of the show to those that, you know, had missed it for so long or have never even watched it before. It's like, oh, here are our old jokes from the seasons before. And in the second season, there's not much of that. It's, yeah, you're right, it has a lot more identity of their own on that show, even though of course there's gonna be a lot of throwbacks on it because that's Full House, but you know, they had their own kind of inside jokes at that point, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that on Netflix and the era it's in now, where it's a lot more less protected now, it's a little more edgier for what they were before. Like, it's still very clean comedy for 2016, 2017, but it's a lot more edgier. If you watch Full House, and you watch Fuller House, and you compare the two shows, this show is 10 times more edgier than Full House was. You use all the innuendos and stuff, too.
Yeah, it's the same thing too with a little off topic here, but Gilmore Girls was the same thing, where there was actually some cursing in Gilmore Girls, whereas the previous series didn't have that, because obviously it was on WB, CW, so...
Oh, yeah, but on Netflix, Full House had no innuendos at all, really, really very little, and
there's some.
The innuendos are very cute, they're very, very innocent.
There's some, yeah. Which cameo did you like? I particularly loved Gravis and Soul, rest in peace, Alan Thicke, who happened to pass away 4 days after the premiere of the second season. But yeah, I love his cameo appearance there.
Who was that? Alan Thicke, right. Oh yeah, Alan Thicke was great. I thought he was phenomenal on the show. Mm-hmm. I like the cameos from all the other characters that weren't necessarily stars. Like, all the other, like, older characters. the names don't hit me right now, obviously, but some of the ones that
were... The boyfriends, right?
Yeah, some of the old boyfriends, some of the old friends from school, and, you know, things that came on, like, one episode per season, whatever, but they had it, they made a mark on there. Those were cool. I thought Full House really made a point to try to bridge some of the gaps, even for people that weren't on the show as much as, you know, somebody, you know, some of the characters. I thought they did a good job with that. But I tell you what, though, like, season one was about Jodie Sweetin, about Stephanie. Like, I was like, whoa, this girl looks good. But honestly, I've kind of fallen back in love with DJ, with Travis Cameron. Like, to me, she is like a, like, to me, I look at her today, you know, especially knowing who she is now, very conservative, which I love, obviously. But she has kind of like that golden age, like, kind of that kind of the Hepburn, you know, really classy look. She's like a classy actress type, you know, but very sexy in a way. Not sexy where it's obvious, but sexy enough. Like, to me, she's really aged well. And I think she's probably my favorite character on the show.
Yeah. She's, what, 40 years old right now? Like,
she's 39, 40 years old. She takes care of herself. She's phenomenal. She's done a great job with exercising and stuff, and she's very healthy.
Yeah, well, they all look good. Like, even Tammy Gilbert, I was about to make fun of her. Like, she looks good for her age, too.
She's adorable.
Yeah, and I also like, you know, because Full House is mostly a white bread kind of show, right? But I appreciate that they had a Latino person in there, and they had an Asian girl in the show as well.
Asian best friend, and then Kimmy's estranged husband, or whatever the hell they are now, fiancé, or ex-fiancé, whatever the hell it is. Yeah, I mean, he's a bit much as a character, but I think they've done a good job now. I think as season two went on, they started to really blend him in a lot better on the show. I thought he would have been an issue during season one, but been a little better now in comparison to season one.
Aren't you excited there'll be a third season? Because they just announced it like last week or something like that.
Oh yeah, they announced it already. Season 3 is going to come next year. I'm excited about it. I think the show, you know, it has the following of people like us who are of that generation. Like I said, the success of the show, and that was the thing I was worried about. Like, you can only rely so much on the nostalgia side of it. At some point, the show has to stand on its own two legs. And it has. And season 2 was really the coronation of that. And I think they've done a great job with season 2. The way they really... I think the character building of season 2 really was great. I thought they did a great job there.
Yeah, exactly. And hopefully, this new generation of Fuller House fans, they can go back to... I wish Netflix had Full House by itself, but they can go back to DVDs or even YouTube or stuff like that and, you know, watch the old series and see how it was when DJ and Stephanie and Kimmy Gilbert were kids, because, you know, then you can see all the characters from Fuller House and how they were back to kids. Like, it's just all interesting to see how far they've come, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So, one more thing before I let you go. Shout out to my buddy, TJ Perkins, who, by the way, wrestles in WWE now, former Cruiserweight champion. But he was on Fuller House also as one of the wrestlers. Yeah. He told me about it before the series came out. But yeah, he was one of the wrestlers.
Okay.
Yeah. You should watch that over again. Yeah. And by the way, sweet moves by DJ on that. That was all her. Yeah, so, cool. Thanks, DJ.
Of course, Ray, of course.
This is Anthony Irwin, and you are listening to the Ray Ray is Fundamental podcast. Whatever happened to predictability? The milkman, the paper boy, evening TV.
Yeah. Before we move on to that interview with Matt Moore of CBSSports.com, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can also download the show on Stitcher and RareRay.net, and this show is being syndicated by the Happy Hour Network. Follow me on Twitter at TheNoloCast, and follow the podcast Twitter at RareRayIsFun, because you cannot fit RareRayIsFundamental for a Twitter handle. Anyway, here we go, Matt Moore, NBA Talk, get educated, scratch! RareRayIsFundamental Podcast, episode 66. This is Ray Morali, also known as RareRay. And joining me as always, the greatest storyteller of all time, Adam Jacoby. What is up?
Not a whole lot. I'm beginning to believe you when you call me the greatest storyteller of all time. So, up yours, Garrison Keillor. I win.
Yeah. And per tradition, these days I have it on the first guest of the year. For the third year in a row, CBS Sports. Super NBA writer, Matt Moore. What's up?
Let's begin 2017 and hope, by God, it's better than the last.
So, how was your year personally, 2016? Personally. Aside of those celebrities dying and, president-elect.
So, the question is, if I share this story, how much do you think it'll get shared? Because I have a medical story that will make the hair on the back of your neck stand up and will make your insides crawl.
Keep going.
So,
my wife and I got done having kids, and we had our second this last June. Baby girl, Isla, she's beautiful, healthy, everything's amazing. Mm-hmm. Decided we were done, and especially after about six weeks of having two kids, we realized, done. Over. So, I call up my friendly doctor and say, hey, I'm thinking about being done with such things, and it's real. I've known for a long time. It's really, there's a lot of health risks with women having their tubes tied, and so I was never going to ask my wife to do that, which is good because she would have slapped me. And so I was more than happy to go ahead and have my procedure done to remove such concerns.
Okay. A little snippety doodah.
A little snippety doodah. No big deal. Goes in, have the consultation. He says, it's going to be rough the first 24 hours. You're going to need a lot of ice. It's going to be rough, but then second day is better. Third day, you're pretty much back to normal. A week, no big deal. All right, hey, you know what? No, I've researched it. There's no concerns about all of these things. I did all my research, was all ready to go, no problem. Go in, have the procedure. Took a lot of drugs for it, by the way. They give you a lot of drugs for this. Go through the procedure. Everything seems fine. He says, call me if there's a concern. I was like, well, okay, what's like a concern? And he says, well, okay, if it's a baseball, don't worry about it. If it's a softball, give me a call, let me know, but it's probably okay. So the next morning, I call him because it is approximately twice the size, like two softballs. So I call and I say, hey, this seems like a problem. He says, I need to see you right away. I say, okay. So I go in. When you've had this particular procedure done and then you drop trowel and the doctor that has done the procedure audibly gasps, you know that you are in trouble.
I'm sorry for laughing at your misery.
No, it's funny. No, I told the story to my urologist later, and he was, like, on the floor. And he was like, I'm sorry, it's not funny. So he audibly gasps and says, wait here, I need to go call someone. And that's when, like, I start losing it, right? Like, when the guy that has done this to you is like, I'm freaked out and have to go call someone, that's when I was like, oh, God, what is about to happen? So the problem is he goes out to call somebody, but his office is next door to the office I'm in. So I can hear through the wall. And I hear him on the phone with a urology specialist, and he says, I'm really concerned. I've never seen anything like this.
Okay.
And so I hear him go, uh-huh. So it's not life-threatening. And I'm like, okay. Good dude.
You step up.
He comes back in and is like, so it's rare, but sometimes this happens. There must have been something that got nicked during the procedure. And I'm like, you think? So long story short, I had a pretty rough year in 2000.
Why are we laughing?
So like, oh, man. Just so you're aware, I couldn't get out of bed for 2 weeks. I couldn't get out of bed. Because a funny thing is gravity. Gravity's a problem in that situation.
So
here's the thing. Try and imagine having to explain this situation to your boss at work for what your situation is. And because part of it also is, there's only two ways to go about explaining this, and I had to basically go two ways. I either had to say, I went with either, I had some complications with a medical procedure and left it at that, or you have to go full bore. You can't half tell this story.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you can't say I've got some ball complications in 2 weeks.
Right. You have to go like full bore. So half the people in my life are really confused and think I have this mystery medical ailment, and the other half are like, why would you ever tell me this story? I'm never having this procedure ever. Which is unfortunate because the odds are really, really slim. I was basically told that my odds of having anything nearly as severe as 1 in 500, and the urology expert was like, I would say it's closer to like 1 in 1,000. Like, it's just not, he's like, this is one of the worst cases I've ever seen.
So what's the name of the condition?
I don't know if I can tell you that.
Because you don't remember it, or because it sounds worse?
Because it sounds, okay. Technically what I had was a severe scrotal hematoma.
Why did I ask? What? There's a maxim that says don't ask questions that you don't want the answer to. I don't think I wanted
so
that.
I'm hurting right now. Like, listening to this entire... It hurts so much just listening to
And so here's the thing, is like, it's an embarrassing story, but I didn't do anything wrong. So at some point, I kind of had to think through that and be like, wait a second, this is nothing for me to be embarrassed about. I didn't do anything. Although I did almost make a beat reporter, like, piss himself, because I walked in and he was like, what's going on with you? He's like, I see that you got medical things. And I was like, do you really want to know? And he's like, I really want to know. So I took him to the side and I told him. And, of course, like, his face starts, like, his jaw starts dropping like the girl in the ring. And at the end of it, and I say, but I have good, I was like, but there is an upside. And he says, what? And I lean over and I say, for the first time in my career, I have the biggest balls in an NBA arena.
Yes! Yes!
Is that a segue?
I want to also note, this botched procedure was in October. Mm-hmm. You'll note the date today.
Yeah. January.
Yeah, it's not resolved. It's better. It's not totally resolved.
Well,
but you still have big balls.
Hey, so let's talk basketball.
Yeah. So,
just FYI, you're now the greatest storyteller to ever appear on this podcast. Damn, man. Yeah.
It's been really funny because every woman I tell the story to, and there haven't been many, but the women I tell the story to are like, that sounds horrific. And every man that I talk to looks at me like, do you need a hug? Can I hug you?
That's how I feel right now. Like, yeah. You can't see me, but my jaw was dropped the entire time you're trying to slur.
The part of it, though, is like, I was never like in danger. And like, I'm thankful for that, right? Like, there's like a million things that could have gone way worse. Like, my dad had hip surgery and then had complications and an infection from it. Mm-hmm. And so like, there's been like there are serious medical things that can go wrong with you.
Right.
I just had. Never mind. I'm not gonna say. Let's just go before I say something even worse. Let's just go.
Yeah. So from balls to basketball. Balls. Anyway, has this season been fun for you, Matt?
I've loved it. It's been fun every second. This season is amazing because every single night, it's super competitive. Every single night, it's guys dropping things like Harden's 53-16-17, which was just a Russ's 45-11-11. Isaiah Thomas scored 52, and it wasn't even nearly the best performance inside of a week. The Warriors are awesome, but they're just vulnerable enough to keep the conversation interesting. To where, if you're a Cavs fan, you can say, yeah, but 3-1, and we beat them on Christmas. And then they're just good enough to where it's like, all right, yeah, they're dominant. But the Spurs fans are like, but we housed them in Oracle. And they're just dominant to where the Rockets are like, but we got them in double overtime at Oracle. So they're this dominant super team that's just competitive enough. And the rest of the league has a lot of super interesting storylines. The young guys have come on. Giannis is a revelation. Every single night there's a matchup. Like tonight, I looked at the slate and was like, ugh, this isn't really a good slate. And I was tired. I've been in the city all day with my kid. And yet I find myself captivated by Celtics Sixers because Joel Embiid is doing amazing things. The Celtics are really fun. Giannis Porzingis. Like every night it's another thing. It's great.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I never bought into the, you know, it's not going to be fun because we already know who's going to win the title, you know, all of that, or who's going to be in the finals at the very least. And I didn't see the spate of 50-point games coming. Like, they said that we're already at 8 different guys to hit 50 this year. Like,
yeah.
That ties the record, and we're barely into January. I feel like by March, we're going to start getting 50 burgers from, like, let's pick a name out of a hat here.
On Whiteside.
Bradley Beal. Yeah, you know what? Whiteside. Why not? McCollum. I'd put about 12-1 on McCollum doing it. You know, so it's been a lot of fun. Giannis, I did not see coming. I knew he was good. I knew he was getting better. But he has rocketed through the ceiling. He's starting to figure out that there are things that he has the angle to do that defenders don't ever expect someone to have the angle to do. And he's, you know, really growing into the frame, using it fully. That the one dribble from half court dunk that he did from the, you know, from basically one step inside the free throw line. I mean, that was nuts. That was within 6 inches. I did the math. It was within 6 inches of a free throw dunk in the middle of the game while being guarded off the dribble. Like, that is bananas. And you're right. You can't, at this point, you can't say, well, yeah, Golden State's definitely winning the West. San Antonio's within 2 games. Houston's within 3. You know, and San Antonio's just good enough. And they still have, like, the deaf Golden State squad still hasn't beaten them in the playoffs. You know, you can't automatically assume that it's going to be more. There's no X amount for there to be more the same of, and assume that that's what's going to get Golden State past them.
Well,
what's that?
Part of it. Well, and part of it, it's important to remember that the ideal NBA season is this. The results, the end matchup is what we all wanted in terms of the best teams meeting for the championship, but the road to get there is highly dramatic. That's why last year's playoffs were so good, because you know, it was Warriors versus Cavs with an unpredictable finish.
Totally.
And the Warriors struggled against the Blazers a little bit, the Thunder a lot, and were on the ropes and almost out and had to come back. That was like the most, if the East had been a little bit more competitive, it would have been perfect. And that I think is the model for how the NBA is, where you really want it to where, it's a hyper dramatic finish between the two best teams, but the road to get there is really complicated and interesting. That to me is the ideal for the NBA.
Yeah, and it doesn't even have to be the two number one seeds either.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because I see some fans when they see dominant teams, super teams, whatever, they want more parity. But yet, when the parity does happen, you know, let's say there's like 8 50 win teams in the West or whatever, then they want dominant teams. So, you know, it's funny how the fans just can't make up their mind about that.
Well, and we get a lot of, the other thing is we get a lot of, when there's one dominant team, we get a, man, this league is trash. Like, look at all these other teams. Like, they're just terrible. Mm. And it's like, no, like, because that's part of how I feel
watching
about
them?
That's how I feel about the East, where I'm like, look, Chicago has nights when it looks absolutely terrible, but Chicago's got a lot of really good wins. There's a good team somewhere inside Chicago, and there's a really good team somewhere inside, not really good, there's a decent team inside the Pacers. Like, a lot of these teams mm-hmm. that are below 500 are right at it. Like, there's a good team somewhere in there. They're just trying to figure it out. And that was kind of what happened last year, too, was, you know, for half the year, we were freaking out because it looked like everybody was terrible. But by the end of the year, the East was actually really pretty solid. They just couldn't match up with the Cavs because the Cavs hit a whole other level. So that's kind of – that, to me, is partially the difference.
Yeah. You mentioned San Antonio, Adam. And I know Matt wrote an excellent article about Kawhi Leonard, how the numbers defensively go down when he's on the floor. And you also mentioned, Matt, that you don't believe him as much. At least that was like last month or something like that. That you don't believe the Spurs are on the Warriors level. What are they now to you?
You know, I mean, here's the thing. They're going to win a lot of these regular season games. But I pay a lot of attention to... I've evolved to a point where, with how I watch the NBA, where I look for a lot of context. Like, certain things are just kind of taken. Because it's like, if you start talking about what are the weaknesses with San Antonio, everybody's like, yeah, but the record. I'm like, I'm not debating the record. I'm not debating they're going to finish top five, top three in the West. I think they're going to finish in the top three. They're going to win a lot of regular season games. But it's not just what you observe, because you can observe things and be biased against it, and you're just going to have natural, like, if you want things to be more competitive, you'll think the Spurs are better, because you're going to want to believe in a Warriors matchup. If you're Warriors, if like a lot of media members are, like if you're Warriors kind of preferential because you love how they play basketball, you're going to constantly find things to nitpick with these other teams and kind of ignore what Golden State does. I look more at things like this. When Greg Popovich starts complaining and bitching a lot about what's going on, that's when I start thinking, like, okay, then there's something going, there's something here. Because you could say, like, well, he's always pretty upset. No, he wasn't mad in 2014 because he knew how good that team was. He wasn't mad in 2013. He knew how good that team was. You know when he was mad? 2011, when they got knocked off by the Grizzlies. He was complaining about their defense the back half of that year because it was bad. And this year, he's had real problems and complained about the performance of particularly the starters. There are significant issues with San Antonio. They are disciplined enough and talented enough, and Popovich has instilled a culture that is so good and the system is so solid that they're able to compensate for it, and they're going to beat the Bucks when they have a bad night. And the Bucks are a good team, so they're going to really beat the Suns when they have a bad night. A lot of things have to go wrong for the Spurs to lose a regular season basketball game, but that's entirely different from how they're going to match up in a playoff series, because the biggest issue, I think, with San Antonio is – what we kind of learned last year is their ceiling is only so high. That, to me, is their biggest concern. Because they played the first four games versus the Thunder at a really high level, and they couldn't get the advantage. And that, I think, is a big concern for them long-term going forward. There are certain things that are inherent in their system. Like, Greg Popovich is not going to bench Tony Parker and Pau Gasol because he's got too much respect for veterans. He's not going to bench them outright in a playoff series, at least until games three or four. And if you have those two guys on the court, teams are going to spread everybody else to the weak side of the floor and attack those guys in pick and roll. And that's going to happen every single time. And when you have specific liabilities that stand out to that degree, I think you really do have a huge concern. This doesn't mean that I don't think that the Spurs can make the Western Conference Finals. I think they can. If you ask me, can they beat the Warriors? Yeah, if they were to radically change over this back half of the season, absolutely. But it would take a lot of things changing inherently with how they play and who they play for them to get there.
So, two questions here. One, is this a fixable problem with a trade? You know, similar to what Cleveland did with Korver, are they one body away, or is this a you know, Titanic leaving the port situation?
A lot of it's going to be on Popovich, because Popovich is not infallible. He's just the best coach ever in the history of professional sports, in my opinion. But he's made mistakes, and he'll cop to that. Like, there have been series when he's mismanaged things. It took him a long time to make adjustments sometimes. When they've struggled, it's because he's been late to make adjustments. And I think even last year he struggled with that a little bit. There's an adjustment that's there, and it's basically start Dwayne Dedmon and play Patty Mills early. You can play Parker 5 minutes to start the first, hope to get out to a good run. If you're doing well, keep it up. But then basically if things get tough, immediately pull the plug and go to Mills. Their lineups with Mills, Dedmon, and Kawhi are lethal because they can all defend. They finish. Those guys play Spurs basketball at a really high level. They have the lineups there in order to make the kind of adjustments, and they still have a lot of guys that are going to step up. And Tony Parker, if you're in a stretch where, all right, it's not about defense this game, we got to outscore them. Tony Parker is still who you want running that offense. His hesitation dribble is still amazing. He is remarkable. But the defensive issues are really real. They do have counters. They have the third best defense in the NBA for a reason, because they have all of these really great defenders. But it's just been fascinating, and this is where that article came from, and it's stayed true because I keep tracking it, because a lot of people said, well, this is just early season. Well, it's been a month since I posted that article. Kawhi Leonard is still tied for the highest on-floor defensive rating amongst the Spurs. And that's got nothing – if you haven't read the article, that's got nothing to do with how Kawhi plays defense. It's got to do with the fact that teams are able to put Kawhi in a corner, and they attack everybody else 4-on-4. And the Spurs are not getting stops because LaMarcus Aldridge is not playing as well as he did last year defensively. And Pau Gasol is a train wreck. And Tony Parker is just limited physically. And quite honestly, I really do think that they missed Tim Duncan. There are answers there. I don't think they need to make a trade. Although if they were able to con the Hawks into doing and if they found a third team that like, all right, let's say the Nuggets. Let's say that they offer the Nuggets, hey, we'll give you LaMarcus Aldridge if you'll send all of your good guys, like all of your like Nurkic and Moutier and Gary Harris, first-round pick, like everybody except Jokic and Jamal Murray, because the Nuggets aren't trading those dudes. Send everybody else to Atlanta, and then the Spurs get Millsap?
Ah.
Then they're fine. That trade would do a lot for them. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that they need to make that trade in order to get where they want to go.
Sure. And then part two of the question, other than the Warriors, who are going to be a problem for everybody, who's the biggest matchup liability that the Spurs would have in the playoffs over 7 games?
It's an interesting question because of this. All right, so one thing I've noticed over the years, and I started tracking this in about 2010, the Spurs have real problems with hyper-athletic big men. Now, that's pretty redundant, which is like everybody has problems with hyper-athletic big men. But the Spurs specifically, because they don't have leapers. That's not what they do, right? They have fundamentally sound players, and it's very difficult to find fundamentally sound players that are hyper-athletic. You just can't combo that. Duncan would get really ripped to shreds by Dwight in a lot of games. That's why Houston's record versus the Spurs is actually pretty positive over the last couple of years. They have trouble with big, athletic, long, big men that can run the pick and roll. And guess what? Clint Capella fits that to a T. That's why Houston was able to get that game from them early this season. He gives them a lot of problems. D'Antoni does well against the Spurs. The Spurs have just always done a little bit better. This is also not the 2007 team that managed to get past them or the 2008 team, because this team isn't defense first. They are offensive-centric, and then defense is kind of that's hard to say. Now they may actually be back to defense first, but this isn't the same kind of grinded out, ugly, physical defensive squad that the Spurs had from 2003 to 2010. This isn't that kind of team. They transitioned and went to more of an offensive system, and they're still great defensively, but it's just the mentality's a little bit different. I think that the Rockets would give them a world of trouble. I think that the Spurs demolish the Grizzlies. They just annihilate them. I think the Clippers, it's a coin flip. I think the Rockets are a team that could really give them problems, but every Spurs fan is going to feel comfortable because of their history versus Mike D'Antoni, and I get that. But you're talking about a Rockets team and James Harden that has given the Spurs trouble. Harden gave them trouble when he was with the OKC. He's given them trouble in Houston. He has a good core around him. They have shooters, and they're playing better defense than they're kind of getting advertised as. I really don't like that matchup for Houston, especially if that's a 2-3. It's going to be a hell of a series, but I'd probably take Houston right now.
Can we take them seriously? The Rockets? Can they go all the way?
No. You can't beat Golden State. Like, no matter what you do, you're still not gonna beat Golden State. Like, I've sat here and told you all the reasons why it's like they're vulnerable and all this, but I mean, you still gotta beat all of those guys in a 7-game series when they have home court.
Right.
Could Houston match up? Yeah. Like, I mean, if you told me like, hey, Houston's gonna have a 3-2 advantage in a game 6 at home in the fourth quarter and have a lead, I'd be like, I believe that. And if you told me, and they win, I'd be like, nah, quit playing. That's not right. But I think that Houston can make a run. We'll see. Like, does this Warriors team have an extra gear? Have they learned that after the last couple of playoffs? Are they able to get to? Are they going to? The Warriors are interesting also because when their defense is bad, it's not bad; it's horrific. It's just like miserable defense. When they're great, they're just this smother. They're a fire blanket that just extinguishes you. So which is it going to be? And how are they going to play Harden? And there's a lot of questions that go into that. And it's interesting, but my base level kind of. Without going to that place mentally yet, because I can't really do that till later in the season, I still think that the Warriors would win probably in six games.
Hey everyone, I'm Matt Moore from CBSSports.com. Listen to Ray Ray's Fundamental as much as you can, as often as you can, because it's awesome, he's awesome, the NBA is awesome, and you are awesome. Have a great day.
Now in my younger days, I used to sport a tag. When I went to school, I carried lunch in a bag. Was forever for my teacher, because I knew I'd get a kiss. Always got mad when the class was dismissed. But when it was a session, I always had a question. I would raise my hand to make a stand, come through my desk and help me with my problems. It was never much. Just a trick to spell and sit, I try to sneak a touch. Oh, wow, I wish I could hold her hand and give her a hug. She was married to the man, he was a thug, his name was Lee. He drove a Z, he picked her up from school, probably at 3 o'clock. I was on her jock, yes indeed. I wrote graffiti on the bus. First I write her name, then carve a bus with my name last. On the looking glass, I seen her yesterday, but still I had to let her pass.
October 2012, and you're listening to Ray Ray is Fundamental Podcast. See you then.
I'll just point this out. The Rockets still have the Angel of Death himself, playoff Patrick Beverley.
Yeah. I mean, somebody's going to get got, so.
Right, it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
Watch out for your knees.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, look, look, Curry had, everyone forgets that, because everyone gets caught up with the knee sprain. Curry had an ankle injury that he suffered versus the Rockets in the first game. And that's that ankle he's had problems with his ankles. Like, durability is just a problem for Steph. And that's okay. Like, he's the best shooter ever. And there's a lot of players that have dealt with those kind of injuries. And he's still healthier than most guys. But, you know, and I mean, I hope that Beverly doesn't hurt him, because I just don't want to see that. And I wish Beverly could play with the intensity that he does without having to do stuff like that. And I know it's a hard line for him to walk, and I respect that, but I just wish it didn't have to be part of it.
Steph Curry was not 100% the rest of the way in the playoffs after he came back. That he wasn't playing up to that same level as before. Is Golden State better equipped with Durant around, but all things considered with the personnel changes, is Golden State better equipped to make it through the playoffs if Steph is not 100% Steph, if he can't go full supernova?
So I wrote an article today that I asked this question. Is Steph Curry necessary for the Warriors? Do they need him?
Mm-hmm.
And you say, like, he makes them better. His gravity. I agree with you. Mm-hmm. He's having a great season. This is his career high in points outside of last season. I agree with you. He's a 40% three-point. He's awesome. I was like, yeah, but that's not the question. The question is, do you need Steph Curry? Because if you don't have Steph Curry, Klay Thompson's probably going to get a few more buckets. Andre Iguodala's going to get a few more buckets. Draymond's going to get a few more buckets. And Durant's going to get a few more buckets. Will they be as efficient? No. But this is on pace to be the most efficient team in NBA history. They don't need to. They're a plus 11.1 in net point differential per 100 possessions. You can shave off half and still be near the top of the league. So the answer, and I don't mean this in an insulting way, and I understand what people are going to think this from me, but basically Steph Curry is the shiniest hood ornament you're ever going to find. Like, he's this amazing, and if you want to say, like, so he contributes nothing? No, he clearly does. There are nights when Golden State has not had it, and Curry has carried them. And Steph can still do that. And if you want to say they need him for when that happens in the playoffs, maybe that's true. But we also have not seen a truly dominant performance throughout a series in the Western Conference Finals or Finals from Steph Curry in these past two Western Conference Championship seasons. And that's not to say that he can't do it. Maybe he's overdue for it. Maybe that's the case. But they've really reconfigured this team, because what this team really is Kevin Durant is awesome. And he's got a lot of really awesome guys around him. It's not necessarily this super team where everyone is sharing and it's this super dynamic. And they're also, it's like Kevin Durant's awesome. And wow, he's got like the best role player imaginable in Draymond Green and the best shooter role player imaginable in Klay Thompson. And oh, by the way, they've also got Steph. who's doing his own thing over here and putting up all these points. But they don't really need him. If Steph gets hurt in the first round, they're going to cruise. They're still going to cruise. Here's kind of the counter to that. If Kevin Durant gets hurt in the first series, they could still cruise. That's what makes this team remarkable. Is they can slip back into Steph doing Steph things, I think, very easily. I worry about his rhythm, because his rhythm has been off this season, but I think he could find it very quickly. The reality is that if I ask, is Steph Curry necessary, it's not about whether or not Steph Curry is good, because that's obviously a stupid question, and it's not about whether he fits on this team, because he can. They just don't need him, nor do they need any of the big four, because that's how much talent they have. I think they probably need Draymond, but other than that, any one of them can go down, and they'll be all right.
Yeah. So, what's more likely to happen? The Warriors getting upset in the West, or the Cavs getting upset in the East?
That's a great question.
Cavs are on another level, man.
They got Kyle Korver.
This is the best Cavs team that there has ever been. This is the best Cavs team that there has ever been. This is the best regular season Cavs team I've ever seen. And 2009 was a monster. I will continue to say that the Warriors would be Cavs would be more surprising, because I don't believe in Boston. I love Toronto, and I think they're really good. And if they add Paul Millsap, I'd be like, hey, that could be a series. But hey, that could be a series is different from you're going to beat LeBron James when he has home court. The Hawks are now done. Like they're through. Charlotte, I like but don't believe in. And there's no one else. There's just no one else in that conference that matters. Versus, Golden State, if they stumble, if they have the same problems, because they've had this issue before where they don't handle adversity particularly well, in terms of they don't have like, all right, you get smacked and then the next game come back and they're like, we're ruining you. They get smacked and they're like, what? What do you mean our shots didn't fall? And then they stumble a little bit more. And then they go, wait, we're going to dig down and we're going to find our way out of it. They did that. They're resilient, because they did that versus Memphis and they did that versus the Thunder. Like, this is a resilient team. But when the shots aren't falling, when those big explosive plays aren't happening, they do lose a little bit of energy. They're not methodical the way the Spurs were. So if you get into a series where you're able to get stops and it's the Clippers or it's the Spurs or it's the Rockets, yeah, there's a potential for those teams to upset Golden State. They have a formula, but, probability-wise, we're still talking very poor odds. Like, if you say there's a 10% odds of a major injury, even with that 10%, you're still only talking, I would say, there's like a 20% chance 2 out of 10 times those teams are going to upset the Warriors, and that feels high, but statistically that's probable. And as an estimation, that's where I kind of get to. Versus the Cavs, it would be like, unless LeBron gets hurt, they're winning the East. That's it.
Yeah. How close is Milwaukee to being a contender?
They are turning in right now. They are looking to me like that team that you're like, man, do not run into those guys in a first round or second round series. You do not want any part of the Bucks. They're like Memphis was, where it was like, you don't want any part of this. Like, this is, they're going to go at you. And that includes the Cavs. Like, the Cavs would probably, even in all honesty, sweep them, because I mean, look, they swept the Hawks last year. The Hawks were a pretty decent team.
Right.
But Giannis would just keep coming at him, and Jabari's a gamer, and they've got really tough guys, and, Dellavedova really does, I think, bring something to the table, though his plus-minus is bad. Brogdon is good. Chris Middleton, they're going to get Chris Middleton back. Greg Monroe has been terrific this season, and no one's talking about it, and it's driving me crazy. He's got the best point differential on the Milwaukee Bucks, a +500 playoff team. He has the best point differential. They are better with him on the floor than when Jabari is on, or when Giannis is on the floor. And his defense has been decent. He has the fifth best defensive rating amongst all of the rotation guys. He's been really decent on that end as well. If he's still on the block, teams should be really trying to go get this guy, because he's played terrific basketball. They have a lot of different ways to hurt you. They have figured out their shooting. Jason Kidd is hilarious, because it's like, his bad coaching is horrible, his good coaching is awesome. And that's like how it goes with Kidd. Are they going to be the Eastern Conference finalists? I don't think so. I trust Toronto's consistency. But, if they wind up at a 4-5, I expect them to win that matchup, and I expect them to give Cleveland a whole lot of trouble. And there's a possibility that Toronto is the one seed, and if that's the case, that second round Toronto Giannis matchup could get dramatic in a hurry.
Yeah,
it's funny, because I was wondering, like, why did the Pistons let Greg Monroe go? Like, he looks really good with the Bucks, but I was watching that Bucks-Knicks game, so, and you wonder where Detroit is right now, and they are struggling with Reggie Jackson on the floor, man.
Yeah, you know, I have not been able to figure out. I've never been able to figure out that team, honestly. Yeah. Like, I've just never been able to figure out like anything about that team. I think they have chemistry issues. Like they have chemistry issues. That's been a thing. Drummond's inconsistent. Drummond doesn't show up every night, and that's a problem. I think they always have been spot, like, their shooting has never been good, and that's a problem. Like, you have to be so good defensively and bring it every single night. So if you have your biggest defensive anchor isn't consistent, and then you don't have great shooting, like, that's a really tough recipe. We'll see what happens. They are still a team. They've got good guys, and they could find a way out of this, but there's a whole lot of, like, those guys just don't seem to like playing with one another, and that's hard to get out of when you're – when you don't have the talent to just start winning games and make yourselves feel better about it.
Mm-hmm. So what is Dwight Howard thinking right now as he sees his Hawks team just get taken down piece by piece?
You know, I think... I don't think he's tried. Like, I mean, he hasn't been a distraction this year. I don't think he's dragged them down. Everybody's been like, yeah, they're worse. And it's like, well, yeah, they're worse because they traded out Al Horford for Dwight Howard. you know, I think I have hopes that, like, Dwight's gonna get healthy and just, like, play low minutes and get healthy and then kind of tack on to a contender at some point. Like, after this contract is done, just kind of sneak onto a team and just block shots and be like Kurt Thomas for a team. That'd be great. No one's going to trade for him, so he's just going to kind of be there. So it's like, at some level, Dwight just kind of has to kind of accept. He's got to make himself happy, however he has to, because his basketball situation is unlikely to change for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're rebuilding per se, because they're still going to keep Schroeder at the point guard spot, right? So they're probably going to be borderline playoff team, I guess.
My understanding is that what they're looking for in trades is picks and young players. And young players don't win in this league. They just don't. Young teams don't win.
Right.
So I think it's going to be tough. And it's like, all right, if you have Dennis Schroeder and you take away Paul Millsap and Kyle Korver and maybe Thabo Sefolosha and maybe all these other guys that are veterans, then how does Dennis Schroeder look then? That's an interesting question that we have not seen yet. We're about to find out, but I think it's worth asking.
Yeah. Well, he'll still have Dwight, I guess, so not good enough for, say, 34 wins in a season or something?
Maybe. You know, they can hang around. They'll probably, like, be right in that mix at the bottom of the East. And look, Budenholzer's a good enough coach. I'm not going to rule out that they can put something together. Like, it wouldn't shock me if they cleaned house, brought in a bunch of young guys or role players, and all of a sudden it comes together, and we're talking about how good Mike Budenholzer is. He's a really good coach. He's a really great defensive coach, and he makes a lot. I mean, Pero Antic, who is no longer in the league, was his starting center in 2014, and that team still made the playoffs and was still a problem for the Pacers. Mike Budenholzer is a damn good coach.
Yeah. But, I mean, you can be a damn good coach in the NBA, and if you're as limited on the wings as Atlanta is now, and that's not changing, you know, then all of a sudden those guys that you think are, well, you know, they're pretty good. Yeah, you know, Schroeder can be the starting point guard on a 20-win team with a good coach pretty easily. I could see that, too. And they're just, you know, Bazemore's not that good this year. Tim Hardaway Jr. is, he was good at Michigan, you know. Against Big Ten defenders, sure, give me THJ all day. They don't have the personnel. I thought they would look better than they did this year. Beginning of the year, I'm like, you know, they're not, with Howard in there, they're not going to miss Horford too much. They miss him. And
they got off on 9-2 start, too. 9-2 start, and then they lost 10 of 11 after that.
Yeah.
They need to request from the league, they need to be like, whatever you have to do, just don't send us on the long West Coast road trip. Every year they do this. They go on that West Coast road trip, and it happens to most teams. Like, most teams you'll notice, like, the Raptors lost to the Suns in the middle, like, towards the end of that. Like, they lost to the Suns and then came back and beat the Jazz. Like, that's what happens, is those road trips, those West Coast road trips for the East teams, it's just tough. And the Hawks always struggle on them, and then they get back from them, and they're tired, and it takes them a while to get out of it. That's what's kind of, this is the weird situation, is I really think that Atlanta probably would have eventually pulled out of the slump, but you have to think with them moving Korver that they're going to be looking to really reconfigure things. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we'll see what, yeah, we'll see what happens. We've also been hearing that they're going to trade Millsap for 2 years now, and they haven't done it. So we'll see. They were talking to everybody about blowing it up last year and couldn't pull the trigger. They have dissent inside the top of that organization. And when not everybody's on the same page with what they want to do, it gets really tough to – it's really tough for a guy like Mike Budenholzer to be like, yes, trade my best player. That's a tough decision for a coach to make.
Yeah.
So for some reason, Adam Jacoby's question to Matt Moore – about whether when Boogie's going to get traded or not, got cut off. The audio didn't record. So here's his answer, and we go into a long explanation.
So this is how I've tried to describe it to people. Whenever I from what I've, the people I've talked to, which is I'm not like Captain Sources over here, but the conclusion I've come to is this. In political science, as you may have heard on Twitter, there's a theory called game theory. It's actually... it's actually an economics principle or a mathematics principle, depending on how you consider it. But one of the things
I've taken a class.
Right.
I'm versed.
Awesome. So from a political perspective, which is where I learned it, the important thing to remember in any sort of game theory is that in order to properly be able to describe and predict what happens in a game theory matrix, both sides have to be rational actors. So they have to both say, this is in my best interest, and therefore I will pursue it, and say, even though this action is against your best interest, which is in my best interests, it is so against my best interest that I won't do it. You have to have rational actors on both sides in order for any of the theories or predictions to work. The Kings are not a rational actor. because of their ownership, which is not Vivek, I would say. One of the things that people miss about the Kings is that there is a lot of hens in that hen house, and they are all clucking all at once. The minority ownership group is very active and very boisterous and leaks everything. All of the leaks that come out of there, at least to my theory, as far as from an outside perspective, because I have not spoken with them, but from my understanding, from a third-party outside perspective, a lot of the leaks that come out are as a result of the minority ownership group, and that complicates things. Is Vivek out there? Yeah. Like, I appreciate the guy and his mind for business and how he approaches technology. Like, he's a futurist, and that I can appreciate. But to a certain degree, there's just uncertainty because he's not willing to be like, I'm going to follow set principles that have worked in the past in order to establish a winning culture. He still very much wants, he's gotten away from it to a degree, and that's why you see this team kind of succeeding a little bit more, Dave Yeager and Vlade playing a more traditional style. But they're always going to be kind of bending those limits, and they're just, it's not a rational actor. So I don't know how to accurately predict what's going to happen with Cousins, because the best thing for him is clearly a trade. And you say, but there's talent and this, that, and what if they turn it around? I just look at it and I say, what's the more likely probability? If you're going to sim this out 1,000 times, what's going to happen more often? The well is going to get poisoned, it's going to result in a blow-up, and you lose value in your trade? Or you make a dynamic trade, you try and get as far ahead of it as possible, you get good assets from a team that is desperate for a star, and you put together a team that your fans will love because they really are dynamic, and you get rid of a guy that honestly has to be in the right situation. Like, it's not the end of the world. Part of this is my thing. It's not the end of the world if you lose Cousins. You've missed the playoffs for 12 years. You've been a joke for 12 years. You're not losing out on KG, who took the team to the playoffs and had them as a Western Conference contender. That's not the situation. You've never been able to figure it out with Cousins. A fresh start is probably the best thing for all involved. But again, to me, the problem is you're not dealing with a rational actor.
This is TJP, and you're listening to the Ray Ray's Fundamental Podcast. Lord, I've really been real stressed, down and out, losing ground. Although I am black and brown, problems got me pessimistic. Brothers and sisters keep messing up. Why does it have to be so damn tough? I don't know where I can go to let these ghosts out of my skull. My grandma's bad, my brother's gone. I never at once felt so alone. I know you're supposed to be my steering wheel, not just my spare tire. But Lord, I ask you to be
my guide and force the truth. For some strange reason it had to be. He guided me to Tennessee. Take me to another.
This is Lana Berry from The Lana Berry Show with Lana Berry, and you're listening to the Ray Ray is Fundamental podcast, and Adam Jacoby is a terrible person.
Kings have had, what, 9 coaches in the last decade?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Oh,
Jesus.
That's crazy. Yeah.
So go ahead. Boogie, and I'm sure I'm the 1,000th person, and by 1,000th I mean first. But this situation reminds me of former Iowa Outland Award winner Robert Gallery, the second overall pick in like the 2000s.
Raiders, right?
Yep. Yeah. But it was turn of the century Raiders, which meant that they were cycling coaches like every year, which meant cycling coordinators every year and cycling offensive blocking schemes every year. And so all of a sudden, this guy who was a can't-miss pro prospect starts getting bounced around, moved around different positions, and amazingly, shockingly, the Raiders were bad every year. And a lot of it was, well, but you got this offensive lineman. Those are the safest picks in the draft, and you're not even getting all-star seasons or all-pro seasons out of him. Well, what's wrong with this guy? And it's like, you might want to zoom that one out a little bit. there is such a thing as a situation being placed in a situation to succeed. And there's being placed where you're not going to succeed. And I think that is making the situation a lot more difficult for Boogie, who I'm sure is acutely aware that there are things working against him that he has no control over, including his ownership.
Now, I agree.
He'll also blame the refs and the media, and he has more control over that than he'll admit. But there's some stuff that is working against him that he just can't do anything about.
I agree. I would say this, though. The idea that he is not culpable for any of it is not accurate.
I don't want to say that.
And it's not just the on-court laziness or the text or the official stuff or the media stuff or any of these other things. My thing has always been that his critics don't appreciate who he has been to the community off the court enough because he has been stellar. Like, he's really given to Sacramento, and he has given his time and his energy and has really tried to form a connection with the fans, and he is lovable in that regard. And that matters, and that should matter, along with the fact that before Matt Barnes showed up, you can talk about that situation last year with his brother, but that was not him. Before Matt Barnes showed up, he had not been in an off-court incident.
Yeah.
Had not been in one. And that matters to me. Like, that matters. Like, he has not gotten himself in trouble. And I don't even like to go down the road of, like, trouble or not, because it's also, like, these guys, they get to have personal lives, and stuff happens, and who am I to say? It's not my life, it's not my culture, I don't make that money, I don't know anything about it. But beyond all of that, you can't even say that, because he really hasn't gotten in trouble. However, the stuff about teammates and how they react to him, his teammates don't want to sell him out, because he's the best player, and they're trying to make the most of it, and they really do, like, teams form bonds. But he does drive people crazy. Like, that's not a false thing. He's driven every coach he's ever had nuts, including Michael Malone, who he had a good relationship with. He drives guys crazy with his attitude and his behavior, and that stuff does matter. It's with Cousins, it's everything. He is this all-world generational talent that could be the best. He's probably the best center in the league and could be the best center of a good team in the league and an MVP candidate. He is this tornado of emotion that cannot control himself and refuses to accept his role and his lack of maturity. He is a guy that's been the victim of an organization that has been completely inept, dating back through the Maloofs, through the Vivek era, and has never had the kind of consistency and continuity that you need in order to build a good team, and he's had a terrible roster around him. And He's a guy that lazes on defense and doesn't commit himself enough to making winning plays and complains about the officials when he needs to get his ass back on defense. He's always all of these things, and that's what makes it tough to really describe who Cousins is. He's never as bad as his worst critics say, and he's never as good as basketball Twitter will make him out to be.
Mm-hmm. Well said.
Yeah, so I agree. Definitely a fresh start. Fresh start is needed. So, but we don't know where he's going to go from here. At least not this season. What is his contract then? Next year, I believe?
Yeah, I think so. I think 2018.
Yeah, so... Yeah, we'll get that money somewhere, I suppose.
I mean, yeah, everyone kind of thinks that because of the new CBA that he'll just take the money. We'll see. You know, like, guys enjoy that free agency experience. I know that. The first time that they're able to be unrestricted free agents, they cherish that opportunity. We'll see if he just wants the extra money, but, you know, I would also be surprised if he just took the max super extension.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, for whatever it's worth, however many years ago it was, 7-8 years maybe at this point, I remember thinking that some pretty similar things about Zach Randolph in Portland. Mm-hmm. You know, he was, when Memphis said, yeah, we're going all in on Z-Bo, my thought was, what are you thinking? Like, yeah, he'll get you 20 points a night, but have you seen this guy? You know, is he's going to be this divisive, destabilizing figure in your locker room, and the exact opposite has happened. So I mean, maybe it really is as simple as giving Boogie a fresh start. Maybe those bad things that have been endemic in his game for the entire time that he's been in Sacramento, maybe the light turns on for him. Maybe that switch gets flipped and you get full effort Cousins. I mean, maybe 82 games is too much to ask for a full effort, but but you know, maybe that's really all it takes to get that next level out of him. And if that happens, look out, right?
I don't ever doubt that in the right situation, he's going to give the effort that you need to win a championship. To me, it's like he doesn't put the effort in because he never has the discipline around him to get him there. I think the Kings have tried. I don't think it's that they haven't tried, and I don't think it's not that they're not deserving. I wish that they could, but it's hard. Let me put it this way. If DeMarcus Cousins goes to Miami, this story is entirely different. Like,
yeah.
Their culture is just a lot different because Riley, for better or worse, and worse in some ways, that culture eventually molded Hassan Whiteside to where he's no longer a problem. And that was a guy that was driving everyone insane 18 months ago. Just driving everyone crazy.
By the way, second round pick by the Kings as well, the same year that Cousins got drafted.
Right. so, like, if he goes to Boston, they have a better culture. If he goes to... if he went to Orlando, I think Frank Vogel would probably get the most out of him. Because Frank Vogel, like, sets a certain tone. Now, the team probably wouldn't be any better because the roster's a mess. He goes to Dallas. Things are better. They have the culture. He goes to San Antonio. Obviously, they have the culture. Like, having that culture really matters. And the Kings have not had it, and they have not had stability, and they have not had... Part of it also is just accountability. This is the problem, is the small markets get so desperate to keep their star happy so he doesn't demand out that they wind up not instilling discipline. And you have to have accountability for everybody. It's not just the stars. Everyone's got to be accountable. You have to be able to say... Because the star has to be held accountable so that you can then turn around and say... I'm going to hold you accountable, role player, because I hold the star player to the same standard. And you have to have that. And the Kings have not had that, and that's a problem. Because, you know, with Cousins, it's like, yeah, he lays on defense, and he's able to say, like, I'm the best player on the team. I got 30 and 15. What do you want? And it's the answer is 30 and 15 doesn't help you as much as playing at a consistent level, possession by possession, on both ends of the floor. And that's right. The complicated right. area of it. But I think if you put him in the right situation, oh, God, he's just... Look, I'll put it this way. DeMarcus Cousins in the right situation, no one's talking, like, we're talking about Joel Embiid, like, hey, maybe someday he can be as good as Boogie. Like, that's the conversation that we get to. Karl Anthony Towns, Anthony Davis. Cousins in the right situation, we're all saying he might be as good as Boogie someday. That's how we're putting it, not, is Joel Embiid better than Boogie Cousins right now? Is Marc Gasol the best center in the NBA? Is, you know, is Anthony Davis the best big man in the NBA? None of those questions are relevant. If Boogie's in the right situation, he will give the effort, and I 100% believe he would be the most dominant, one of the top five player in this league, no doubt.
Yeah.
So, who's MVP right now? Westbrook or Harden? Or anyone else?
I've got Harden right now. The 53-16-17 still fresh. The win over Oklahoma City, though, head-to-head should not matter, but just the way – honestly, the fact that he passed on that final possession matters a lot to me. Like, Harden's willing to make the play that you need to make to win a game. That matters to me. His defense is way better than it's really been described as such this year. It's not good, but there's a category of fine that Harden fits comfortably in right now, and Russ has been that way, and Steph Curry's that way. Fine is where Harden's defense has been. He's – the reason that the Rockets are so good and they are appreciably better than we all expected, and I think that that does matter, even if it's just versus expectations. I think that the expectations were reasonable and he's outperformed them. And I just love the way that he's played. He's played with a real joy and he's managed the most fun team in the league to watch. Their defense is better than kind of described, as I said, and they're winning big games and he's delivered. And he's playing in all these back-to-backs and he's carrying the team on some of them. So that matters to me too. I just think that, overall, it's very, 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 very close. Westbrook's efficiency does matter to me if we're talking about MVP. It doesn't bother me if I'm talking about whether or not Russell Westbrook is awesome, because he's awesome. But it matters to me if we're talking about Russell Westbrook versus James Harden this season. I have to look at things like efficiency, and James Harden grades out a little bit better there.
Is this Mike D'Antoni's best coaching job of his career?
Yeah.
That's a great question. I think you have to look at some of those mid...
Is it too early to say that, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, part of it, though, is also, it's like, look, you know, Eric Gordon is a known commodity. We knew that he was good years ago in L.A., and he had... Honestly, he was good last year. Ryan Anderson, we knew, could be good. He was good in Orlando. But we really learned more than anything about Ryan Anderson and Eric Gordon coming to this team is how bad New Orleans is. We knew Clint Capella, like those of us that pay attention, knew Clint Capella was going to be pretty good coming in. We knew Nene was a serviceable body. So they have a roster versus some of those early 2000s teams. You would look at them and be like, who? Boris, who? Leandro, who? Who are these guys? And he would just make that, I mean, the guy made Tim Thomas into a serious playoff threat one year. That's the most incredible thing.
Oh, God, yeah, he did.
Yeah, like, I mean, he would just find ways to get guys good. What I think more than anything this shows is it's really rewritten his story, and the reason is what it really shows is, look, the problems in New York and L.A., D'Antoni deserves blame for his share of them because he didn't work through some of the problems. He didn't find the solutions that he needed to get that team to win. But the superstars in those situations deserve a lot more of the examination because you see, all right, if you're a superstar and you commit to Mike D'Antoni and you embrace that style, look what you can do. And certain players in both New York and Los Angeles chose not to do so, and that's why we got a narrative that Mike D'Antoni's a bad coach, and that's not what's happening.
Cool.
Right.
So, yeah.
Kobe.
Yeah, I mean, he made Errol Clark into a player.
Yeah.
Obviously, Jeremy Lin. Chris Duhon had 22 assists when he was around, so yeah.
I mean, look, Ray Felton was looking like a really good point guard that first year in New York. That Knicks team before Melo showed up was a lot of fun, and I think would have made the playoffs.
Yeah.
When it was Wilson Chandler and Danilo Gallinari and all these guys, Amari was still marginally healthy. Like that was a team that was a lot of fun. Like I had this awesome shirt. I forget where I get it from, but it was that team on the Ramones logo. And it was like one of my favorite.
Yeah,
shows.
That
team was just hellacious fun, and that was a good sign. I was like, no, you can. And so I never got it because it was like, well, he just did a terrible job in New York. I'm like, things were good, and then you traded for a certain someone, and then things got bad.
Matt, go ahead and publicize your social media, your work. Everywhere else on the internet.
You can find me at basketball. If you don't like volume tweeting, you can find me at MattMoreCBS. and catch me at CBS Sports. I have a big article up on the Warriors that I just put up today. I'm writing basically, I think probably, if I estimate it, 8, 12, 13. I'm going to write probably 12. Probably 6,000 words over the weekend about the Hawks and the different trade situations. And then I'm working on a Giannis thing for the future. And yeah, you can find me at CBS Sports, and thanks.
Mm-hmm. And Adam, your social media.
You can find me at Pontifex. I am tweeting the Pope this week. Lots of Pope jokes. You know, the young Pope meme is hot on Twitter. So I'm just striking while the iron's hot. Just call me Young Pontifex. No, you can find me at Adam _ Jacoby. That's Jacob with an I at the end.
I'm so confused by that show.
I've never watched it, and frankly, I don't know why everyone just keeps saying Young Pope on Twitter all the time. It's like, oh, I put the words Young Pope into lyrics. I mean, why did you do that? But I've never understood why. Are you, why? Anyway, this makes us old, I guess. We're old Pope.
Jude Law. Jude Law. This is who Jude Law is.
Substantially older than we are.
Right.
Anyway, no, at Adam _ Jacoby, with an I at the end. _ critically important. You can also find my work at goiowaawesome.com, where we are currently celebrating, as everyone is, I'm sure, aware, currently celebrating the retirement of our outgoing offensive coordinator, Greg Davis. And maybe, just maybe, in the year of our Lord 2017, Iowa will throw the ball downfield.
And advice for everybody, Adam.
Well,
so we can end the show.
Of course. I mean, gentlemen, there's no need to be bugging when it's a Ninja Turtle you're hugging.
Thanks for wasting my time. Happy 2017, guys. Game over,
yeah! Hashtag blame Ray Ray.
Molded.